there is a big need to you know, be on the technological edge. Developing countries don't want to fall you know, short from accessing some of the cutting edge technologies. And the Chinese are providing an interesting deal. You know, like the technology is cheaper and it's not bad quality anymore. Maybe it used to be in the early times, but now firms like Huawei have been able to provide really high quality equipment at a competitive price. So it's hard to turn down these offers when you're a developing nation trying to you know, move forward in your digital transformation.
Welcome to the China MENA podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Fulton, a senior non-resident fellow at the Atlanta Council and a political scientist at Zayed University in Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates. The ambitious Belt and Road Initiative, or BRI, has gotten the lion's share of stories about the expansion of China's global presence. A series of hard and soft infrastructure projects, the BRI is a major push for global status, power, and influence. A less noticed but incredibly influential component of the BRI is the Digital Silk Road Initiative, or the DSRI, which Beijing announced in 2015. In the DSRI, Beijing is coordinating with partner countries to improve telecommunication networks, artificial intelligence, cloud computing, e-commerce, mobile payment systems, smart cities, and surveillance technology. As countries around the world seek to address development issues through digital means, China is playing a major role, and its tech giants have made significant inroads. To explain what the DSRI is and how it's being used to further develop relations between China and North African countries, I'm joined by Tinhanan Alkadi. Tinhanan is a political economy researcher whose work focuses on China and the Middle East, digital technologies and development, and the knowledge economy. She's doing her doctoral studies at the London School of Economics, is an associate fellow at Chatham House in London, and is the co-founder of the Institute for Social Science Research on Algeria. She's also the author of a great policy paper recently published by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace titled How Huawei's Localization in North Africa Delivered Mixed Results. Tinhanan, welcome to the show. So glad you could join us.
Hi, Jonathan. Thanks a lot. Glad to be here.
No, of course. You're near the top of the list. We wanted to get you on here right away.
Thank you.
Well, of course. Thank you. So like I said in the introduction, I assume by this point, everybody has some knowledge about the Belt and Road Initiative, but the Digital Silk Road Initiative hasn't really gotten the same kind of widespread traction yet. Can you give our listeners a brief overview of the DSRI? What is it and why is it important?
Sure. So the Digital Silk Road Initiative, or the DSRI, is the digital component of China's Belt and Road Initiative. It's mainly driven by Chinese tech giants such as Huawei, Alibaba, Baidu, Tencent, among others. The white paper that launched it in 2015 described it as an initiative that aims to promote connectivity across the world. And this comes by installing, you know, fiber optic cables, data centers, smart cities, telecom equipment, including 5G networks across BRI countries. So in Africa, in Asia, in Europe, in Latin America, and elsewhere. But until today, it's unclear what projects fit into the Digital Silk Road Initiative. It seems that virtually every project that is related to telecommunications or data is labeled as a Digital Silk Road project. And in this sense, it's a bit like the BRI, where, you know, it ended up being a rebranding of Chinese investments abroad. But it is a highly strategic initiative. So arguably so far, the digital space has been dominated by the US. And the Digital Silk Road is China's attempt to capture the digital space. And so it is highly important because whoever wins the digital race wins the future in a way.
That's really, really helpful. And the way you're describing it, you're absolutely right. It does sound like BRI. I remember about 4 or 5 years ago talking to a Chinese diplomat in the Gulf and saying, you know, for all the engagement you have with Gulf countries, it doesn't really seem to be part of this grand BRI map that was being published so much back then. And he basically said, anything we do, any kind of bilateral engagement is BRI. It doesn't matter. You know, everything is BRI now. So I think it's the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. In the same way, now most projects that are like in the telecom sector, you know, data centers being built or fiber optic cables being installed, applications from Chinese-based firms are all, you know, labeled digital Silk Road initiatives. So it's unclear, you know, how to disentangle all of that. But I think it's all part of the BRI and the digital Silk Road when it's tech related.
Right. And it's great for the companies, right? Because they could have something that is just, I want to get a contract. But if they put the DSRI label on it, then they're going to get a lot more support from Chinese loaning entities or from government. So yeah, it really does often seem like a brand for some of these larger initiatives. One of the things that we all keep hearing about, especially in the Middle East, is Huawei. And of course, I'm from Canada, and for several years, Huawei was a very, very, very big issue in our relations between Canada and China. How does Huawei fit into this? I mean, you wrote about it specifically in your report. Why Huawei?
Well, Huawei is definitely one of the most important Chinese tech firms in general, but also its presence in the region, in the Middle East and North Africa, is significant. So within the Digital Silk Road, it plays an important role. And we're seeing increasing numbers of like contracts from the region, cooperation agreements with Huawei. And this is because Huawei offers quite an interesting deal. So on average, it tends to be 10 to 30% cheaper than its Western competitors. And at the same time, as you mentioned, like Huawei comes with funding. So often it has access to loans provided by China Development Bank. So it's either the China Development Bank or the China Exim Bank. And this has very much facilitated Huawei access to the African market and the market of many other developing countries. And so we're witnessing an important expansion of Huawei across the region. It has built the backbone infrastructure for most North African countries, actually. And because it played a significant role in building 3G networks and then the shift towards 4G, also, it's very likely that Huawei will be an important player in the 5G, in the shift towards 5G. And so, yeah, recently we're seeing also a cooperation emerging in the field of cloud computing and artificial intelligence. Many developing countries are signing cooperation agreements with Huawei to cooperate and develop AI capabilities, for instance. And some of these countries include the United Arab Emirates and Egypt, among others. So Huawei has a very important presence in the region and is definitely one of the most significant actors to analyze when looking at China's digital Silk Road in North Africa.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mentioned Huawei, I mean, first, because obviously it's part of your great paper, but it's also really a hot button issue, especially in the US, for a lot of countries where they have significant cooperation agreements or even alliances with a lot of countries in the region. And Huawei seems to be at the center of a lot of that. I mean, for all of the protestations from Huawei that it's purely a commercial entity, there have been a lot of questions about that narrative, that it maybe isn't just a commercial actor, maybe there are political components to what Huawei is doing as well. And we've seen several countries have put up barriers to Huawei 5G network equipment, and others have banned it outright. Why is it? Why is it that you know, some countries have a hard time believing that this is you know, a commercial project or a commercial company only?
Mm-hmm. Yes, you're absolutely right. But I feel that like this debate was more important in high income countries that have more options and the means to, like, you know, get other operators. But in developing countries, the deal offered by firms like Huawei or ZTE, its other Chinese competitor, are actually hard to turn down. And so what we've witnessed is that there's been an increased skepticism towards Huawei in recent years in developed countries, especially during the Trump administration, and in the context of, you know, like trade war between China and the US. And, you know, the assumption is that the Chinese state is using its tech firms to spy on other countries, and that this network equipment is used by the Communist Party to access strategic data. And the reality is that we don't have any strong empirical evidence showing that Huawei is using its network equipment specifically to spy on others. And so, as you mentioned, many analysts see this as being, you know, politically motivated from the side of, you know, Western countries and primarily the US. A country that, you know, is feeling that it's losing in a way the digital race, especially when it comes to 5G. And so many see this attack on Chinese tech as a motivated attack to actually help the commercial interests of US tech firms. When it comes to spying, I think it's a real risk that nobody should, you know, ignore. But then obviously there is this important issue of like evidence of China spying actually through the Addis Ababa headquarters of the African Union. And so there's an investigation that showed that the data was going to Shanghai every day, you know, between the headquarters of the African Union and China. And this was a very important high-level issue when it comes to spying. But the US or other allies are not any better. So obviously there is the famous Edward Snowden scandal, who showed that US tech firms were actually spying on behalf of the US government for years and across the world. More recently, there was the Pegasus scandal that, you know, told us that Israel was using malware to spy on activists, politicians, business leaders across the world. So for developing countries, even though the security argument is important, often like there is an acknowledgement that as long as you don't develop your own local technological capabilities and the ability to like have your locally developed network infrastructure, foreign providers, whether they're Chinese or American, are very much likely, you know, to come with important concerns over you know, security and spying. This being said, the Chinese are offering such an interesting deal, you know, with the funding and all of that, that no Western country has been able, despite some attempts to provide an alternative deal that would help developing countries catch up in terms of digital infrastructure and help their digital transformations.
Yeah, so I really am quite a novice at this stuff, but that's one of the things that I keep hearing about, is that what Chinese firms do is they come in with the entire stack. You know, it's laying cables, it's providing the hardware, it's providing the devices, it's providing the software and the apps. It comes in as a complete kit that allows countries to jump ahead rather than go through this very slow process of building all the stuff and then buying the stuff to fit with it. You know, it just seems really, like you say, it's kind of too good to pass up for a lot of countries.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And there is a big need to you know, be on the technological edge. Developing countries don't want to fall you know, short from accessing some of the cutting edge technologies. And the Chinese are providing an interesting deal. You know, like the technology is cheaper and it's not bad quality anymore. Maybe it used to be in the early times, but now firms like Huawei have been able to provide really high quality equipment at a competitive price. So it's hard to turn down these offers when you're a developing nation trying to you know, move forward in your digital transformation.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's something that really a lot of folks have to keep in mind, is that when you're trying to solve development issues and you're trying to, you know, build that capability for your population, then, you know, you're not going to be so concerned about where it's coming from, especially as you say, there's always going to be vulnerabilities inherent in engaging with foreign tech companies. I was going to bring up Snowden, but you beat me to it. But we all know how, you know, social media companies are using tech in a not very, above the board way. And when I've talked to people around the Middle East about this and said, you know, do you have concerns about Chinese tech companies using your data? Like everybody does, you know, like if Zuckerberg is using it or if Huawei is using it, what does it matter to us, right? So.
Yeah, absolutely. This is often the issue is like, you know, when your equipment is foreign, often the question is like about choosing who is going to spy on you, not whether one is going to spy on you. And yeah, I think like for, you know, when we talk about data sovereignty and like data security, I think, you know, the most kind of pragmatic way is really to be able to do what the Chinese did in a way and to develop in indigenous technologies and firms to be able to really protect national interests and national data in that sense.
Okay, well, I want to step away. I mean, this is really interesting to me because, like I said, I am a novice and I really have to learn more about it. But I want to step away from the tech for just a minute because your paper focuses on North Africa, you know, the countries of North Africa, Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco. How are China's relations with these countries? This is a recent development, or is there a deep Chinese presence that's been there for a long time that people just maybe haven't paid a lot of attention to?
Well, that's a great question. China and North Africa have had really long ties that can actually be traced back to the early days of the People's Republic of China. So during the 50s, the Chinese Communist Party backed liberation movements across the region. And this meant that, you know, North African countries have a sympathetic views towards China. So in Algeria, for instance, it did support the FLN, Front de Libération Nationale, during the independence war against French colonialism. In Egypt also, it helped socialist movements in the country. And so Gamal Abdel Nasser in 1956 in Egypt was actually the first African leader to recognize the People's Republic of China. And so these are like long entrenched relations. The Bandung Conference, obviously in 1955, was an important bounding moment between China and Africa. It was attended by all major North African countries and leaders at the time. However, during the 70s, 80s, and up until the 90s, economic ties were very weak. It was only at the turn of the century in the 2000s when China adopted its going out strategy and later joined the WTO in 2001 that China's economic presence with North African countries started becoming more significant. So we've seen Chinese investments in a myriad of sectors, including energy, agriculture, manufacturing, but also the telecom sector. You know, this economic relationship is problematic in many ways because it does reproduce many patterns of unequal exchange. So China tends to export finished goods to North African countries, and North African countries tend to export unprocessed, low value added goods to China. And this is just a reflection of the nature of North African economies, which lack sophistication and diversification. But with the BRI, there is the hope, especially with the Digital Silk Road, that there will be a qualitative shift in China's engagement with the region.
So just in terms, I mean, I think that's a good overview of the historical trajectory, and it tells us how the state-to-state relations are. But how about, you know, the people-to-people side of things? Do people in North Africa generally perceive China positively? Is there a familiarity? Are a lot of people learning the language? Do they know a lot about the culture and the history?
Well, that's the thing. I think there is a mismatch between China's current economic presence in the region and people's awareness and knowledge about China. So, for instance, China is the first economic, like trading partner of Algeria. But the level of like knowledge by the average Algerian citizen of Chinese culture, language, or history tends to be rather scant. And it's the case across the region. And this is due to a myriad of reasons, but I would say that Chinese influence and culture is lagging far behind Western culture among ordinary citizens in North Africa and the Middle East. But there was this survey actually in 2010, I think, by the Arab Barometer. And it showed that overall people across the Middle East and North Africa had positive views of China. And it showed that, for instance, in Tunisia, over 60% of Tunisians said that they were willing to have stronger economic ties with China. And ironically, it was the countries that had the strongest ties to China, the like Egypt and Algeria, for instance, that had the lowest share of respondents saying that they would be willing to have stronger ties with China. I think that overall, China's positive image in the region is linked to its economic model and its incredible development story as a country that managed to lift out 800 million people out of poverty within like four decades. And so it is obviously a model that citizens across the region admire and look up to. However, I think that China's authoritarianism and its treatment of the Uyghur population especially contributes to hindering China's image among local citizens.
Sure. I think the development aspect that you mentioned is something that people, especially in the West, just don't appreciate enough. When they think, why do people look to China in this positive way? And you think, look, if you're a country that suffered under colonialism, and then you've been suffering under these prescriptive, you know, Washington consensus development models that haven't allowed your country to bridge that gap. And then you see a country that 40 years ago was one of the poorest, least developed in the world, and they've managed to turn things around like this. Of course, you're going to say, how did you do that? Like, you know, I think everybody looks at it as there's something to learn here, and we're willing to listen, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. It is this fascinating development story. And, you know, I think both governments and citizens like look up at China. I think, you know, when you look at income levels four decades ago, many African countries had actually higher GDP per capita than China. And things turned around very fast. So obviously, there are lessons to learn there. The question of the to what extent the Chinese model could be reproduced elsewhere is another question. I don't think, you know, many countries don't have the institutional capacity, for instance, to reproduce like the Chinese model, but there are definitely some interesting policy lessons to learn there.
Yeah, so not to get too deep into the nerd weeds here, but Mehran Kanrava wrote a really good chapter about the China model. And that was one of the points he brought up, was that a lot of countries would like to be able to do this, but they don't have the governmental capacity. Like it takes a lot of resources. It takes a very strong bureaucracy. It takes a very strong state to be able to do this. And there's just not that many developing countries that are equipped that way yet. All important points. I mean, I remember growing up, because I was born in 1975, and we had only visions of China as basically a poor place, you know, growing up. When I talk to my students who were all born around 2000, their visions of China growing up have all been largely positive. Like, oh, it's rich, it's powerful, it's really developed, they've got great tech. And it's also interesting, I think, for people of my generation to realize people of your generation or younger have grown up with very different perceptions.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, I grew up in Algiers in the 1990s. And, you know, at that time already, we started witnessing China's presence. And so, and by the early 2000s, most construction projects in Algeria were conducted by Chinese firms. So it was very common to see Chinese workers around. And clearly already we could understand that, like, you know, China was the next big thing. And I think it's one of the reasons why I ended up learning Chinese at university and living in Beijing for some time.
Yeah. Okay, well, I've got to bring this back to the Digital Silk Road at some point. So this is the point. And we can talk about your paper a little bit here. Looking specifically in North Africa, what kind of projects are Huawei doing throughout the region? I think your project or your paper does a really good job of outlining this. And also, are there any countries that stand out as kind of at the forefront of their engagement with China on these types of things?
Yeah, well, Huawei has some significant projects across the region. So it played a significant role in the upgrade from 2G to 3G, 4G. And now, as I mentioned, it's very likely that it will play a significant role in the upgrade towards 5G across the region. It's also playing a very important role when we look at its enterprise aspect, dealing with firms in installing data centers and cloud computing and cloud capacities for firms. So, for instance, in Algeria, Huawei recently signed a contract with Sonatrach, the state-owned oil company, to install its data centers and manage its data that's now going to be localized in Algeria. In Egypt recently, it signed an important cooperation agreement with the Egyptian government to help the country develop its artificial intelligence capabilities. And so it has all these deals with different universities across the region. It's organizing ICT competitions and providing ICT certificates to engineering students and so on. I think it has, unlike other firms, other Western competitors, closer ties to governments across the region. And it has done a very good job branding itself as a strategic ally in the digital transformation of North African countries. So, for instance, it launched some important development initiatives across the region. There's this Huawei device factory that was established in Algiers in 2019. In Egypt, it created an open lab to conduct research and development activities. And it has, as I said, signed partnerships to do research and training with several local research institutes and universities. However, I mean, we need to keep in mind that this is obviously a profit-oriented entity, and like Huawei is not doing any charitable work across the region. It's obviously a self-interested actor that is trying to maximize its profits. And so there were some issues around, for instance, the factory I just mentioned in Algeria, where the government had concerns about the extent to which there was any value addition there. It seemed that Huawei, like other firms actually manufacturing in the country, was importing kits that were kind of, you know, it's what we call semi knocked off kits or complete knocked off kits. And so that was like the last steps of the manufacturing process, and there wasn't much value addition. So at some point, the Algerian government called this fictitious production and disguised imports. And so the factory had to shut down, along other factories, actually. It's the same thing doing interviews in Egypt recently. The research and development lab does not seem to be doing any significant R&D activities. And so often you have these, Huawei has localized seemingly developmental activities, but then in practice, there is little technology transfer and little value addition taking place within these countries.
Ah, see, so that's what I was going to ask, because you mentioned earlier about the you know, real need for, you know, indigenous knowledge capacity building, and you talk about these you know, Huawei campuses, and the assumption I had was that they'd be contributing to building this local capacity to help these countries get from being reliant on working with foreign companies and then building their own. But you're not seeing that so much, huh?
So from my fieldwork, what I've witnessed is that there is training, and these ICT academies are like flourishing and training thousands of students across the region. However, the training is not contributing really to transferring technology that would help local economies be more autonomous technologically and upgrade and move towards, you know, higher added value activities within. But what we're seeing is that there is training to basically teach future engineers across the region how to use, maintain, and troubleshoot Huawei equipment.
Right.
So they're providing training on how to use their own equipment. And this obviously creates the risk of developing new form of dependencies. So, one of the big questions, like, are we moving from initial dependencies from mainly US technologies and European technologies towards a new form of dependencies? And yeah, this is an important point, I think, that local governments need to be concerned about.
Sure. How about beyond Huawei? I mean, you mentioned at the beginning, there's a lot of these Chinese tech giants that are operating all over the region. Are there any that are taking on big noteworthy tech projects in North Africa?
Well, the Digital Silk Road entails a set of projects that are important. One of the most important, I think, in the region is the Tangier Tech Smart City. So this is supposed to be a smart city built on a very large area. Upon completion, it was set to host over 200 Chinese firms in high value added sectors such as aeronautic, telecoms, automobile, and so on. But it seems that there were some conflicts between the initial Chinese firms that were supposed to build the smart city and the Moroccan authorities. So the initial firm was Heiter, I believe, and there were conflicts over the ownership of the smart city. And now the project has been significantly downsized. And there's another firm that took over, another Chinese firm actually, that took over Heiter's contract. Talking about the Digital Silk Road still in the region, the space is an important aspect actually also of the Digital Silk Road. And there is a Baidu satellite, if I reckon, who built the China Satellite Navigation Office, one of the first Baidu, basically one of the first Baidu satellite offices in the region, in Tunisia. That was through a partnership with the Arab Information and Communication Technology Organization. And so this is an important and one of like the, I believe it's the first of Baidu satellites facilities outside of China. This was set up in Tunisia. In terms of surveillance equipment, firms like Hikvision are making significant inroads across the region. So their presence in Egypt, the UAE, in Algeria as well is very important. They sell surveillance equipment like cameras and sensors. In terms of e-commerce, obviously Alibaba is the leader in the region. Many use Alibaba actually in the Middle East to make purchases. Recently, Alibaba has launched this new important initiative called the Electronic World Trade Platform. And the aim of the platform is basically to facilitate access to e-commerce for small and medium-sized enterprises. So it's basically to integrate small and medium-sized enterprises in developing countries within, you know, the global market. So this is an important initiative. In terms of apps, you see riding apps such as Didi taking increasing the important parts of the riding app markets in places like Egypt. And as I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of state-to-state cooperation and research in artificial intelligence, big data, cloud computing. The UAE recently signed an important deal with Huawei, actually, for cooperation in artificial intelligence.
Yeah, AI is driving so much, especially, you know, in the age of COVID, where that's been really important in a lot of, you know, things that they've been trying to deal with the pandemic. This is all really interesting because I see a similar pattern when you talk about a lot of Chinese development projects in the larger BRI, especially here in the Gulf, where we'd hear $11 billion committed to, you know, Duqm in Oman. And then 5 years later, you go like, wow, there's just one factory so far. There hasn't really been a lot happen yet. Not to say it won't, but so far it's been pretty slow. And I think that's a pretty consistent with a lot of Chinese overseas development in general, is big splashy MOUs followed by slow implementation or maybe no implementation, whether it's disagreements between the host government or whether it's not understanding local environment. There's been enough time that's passed to give us a sense of the trajectory of the DSR in North Africa. So are you seeing a lot of that? Are things, you know, maybe a little more modestly right-sized, or are things still full steam ahead? Do you think, you know, there's still the same appetite for cooperation with China and this type of stuff?
Well, no, you're completely right. Like this whole plan of like, you know, announcing huge investment projects and then not having much in the end is actually very common, not just among the Chinese. I think it's a well researched and known kind of practice to kind of like come say, hey, we're investing so much, we're coming with this huge project, signing all these agreements, and then just facilitate some, you know, contracts for Chinese firms or other firms, depending on the project. And we've clearly seen a lot of that across North Africa as well. In terms of appetite, I think governments across the region do see the Belt and Road Initiative as a golden opportunity to, you know, improve infrastructure, to get some investment, to create hopefully jobs for the millions of unemployed across the region. And the DSR, the Digital Silk Road, is especially important because it can, you know, it brings the promise of creating jobs in the high-tech sector. And North Africa especially is characterized by this millions of university graduates who do not manage to find jobs. Many of them are, you know, telecom engineers or like computer scientists and so on. And so it is seen as an important initiative. It also helps, you know, countries catch up in terms of digital infrastructure. Then the extent to which it's truly helping, you know, development, that is like structural transformation, you know, the move away from low value added activities to high value activities is another debate and is more challenging. And this, it, I think, would really depend on the capacity of local governments to you know, leverage like the presence of Chinese tech giants to extract more technology, to create more job opportunities, and to have them localize truly developmental activities.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for a lot of countries, whatever end of the spectrum they're on, in terms of development or wealth, I mean, tech is seen as the silver bullet that can really address a lot of their problems. I'm going to name drop one of my friends here to see if he actually listens to this podcast, but I have a friend from Singapore named Doug, and he always talks to me about how when he meets with Emirati officials, one thing they're so fascinated by is that Singapore opened this new terminal in their airport. This massive new terminal. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's got like a waterfall and it's got a rainforest and it's ridiculous. People go there, they drive to the airport just to hang out in this terminal. But the interesting thing is they've done this without hiring new staff, because they've just used their AI to find ways to manage their workloads in a more efficient way, so that they can open this whole new terminal without having to hire a bunch of new people. And in a place like the UAE, which is so dependent on foreign labor, to think that they could use AI to manage these you know, human resources issues is very attractive. And you know, what you're describing, North Africa, where you've got a bunch of highly trained young people that need jobs, and if they can get these jobs through DSRI initiatives, then I think, of course, they're going to jump at this.
Yeah.
This will be interesting to see if Doug actually says he's heard this part. I'm going to check with him. Yeah. But I just want to ask, like, What do you think all this tells us about the bigger picture of China, North Africa? Does this look like a sustainable long-term relationship? Does it portend deeper engagement on other realms? Or does it seem like a passing fancy?
I think it's clearly not a passing fancy. As I mentioned earlier, China and North Africa have long entrenched relations, like deeply rooted in history. And North African countries really look at governments, look at China as this like big brother that made it, you know. And so there is this interest in, you know, cooperating with China, learning from China, because it's a recent development history. And so it's you know, different from European countries or and other high-income countries. The thing is that now we're not sure to what extent China is ready to move forward with many of like the promises in terms of investment. We've seen less appetite from Beijing to invest in large-scale infrastructure. And I think, however, that the telecom sector and like data oriented initiatives will remain as a key sector of collaboration between North African countries and China. Then, as I said, the extent to which North African countries manage to really maximize gains from China's presence in the region will depend on their own policies and their capacity to really compel foreign capital to engage in a developmental way. And in this sense, there's the big issue of regional integration, because we're having all these small North African countries and African countries in general negotiating with, you know, China today, the second biggest economy in the world. And I think that, this is very much an issue that needs to be tackled. And more integration at a continental level could really help level the playing field between African countries and China, and hopefully get trade agreements and investment agreements that profit local economies more.
Tinanan, this has been great. I could do this for another hour, but I can't, unfortunately. But thanks so much. I really encourage all of our listeners to go and download your report with Carnegie. We're going to include a link to it on the show page. It's really good if you're trying to get a handle on the DSRI, or if you just want to learn more about what China's doing in North Africa. I think it's a really, really great paper for this. Do you have anything else that you're working on now that you'd like to share? Any forthcoming work or?
Well, I'm working currently on my PhD thesis that looks at Chinese digital investments across the region. And so, yeah, hopefully in a year or so, I'll be able to publish my thesis. Until then, hopefully we have some shorter papers coming up.
Right. Until then, that's the big focus, right, is get this big beast out of your life. Well, good luck with that. I can't wait to see it and read it as a published book someplace or a bunch of papers, because I'm sure it's going to be awesome.
Thanks a lot, Jonathan. Thanks a lot for having me on the show. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. I'm glad. For our listeners, thank you for joining us. Follow us on social media, subscribe and rate the show on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. And I'll see you next show. Thank you very much.
Produced by Heartcast Media.